Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast with a fresh face and a new haircut. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Now, the reason, listeners, for our fresh face, our new haircut, we've even got a new brand of aftershave, is because this is the start of a new series of Not Enough Champagne, which is very, very exciting. We think, we tried to calculate this before we started, we think it's our fifth season, which is generally where series often jump the shark. They try, series 5 of The Wire, always a bit of a climb down from the other 5. Season 5 of The West Wing, also not the best season.
Listen, let's not talk about season 5 of The West Wing.
Okay. We're going to try and keep on the straight and narrow for this one. We have a whole series called From the Cradle to the Grave, and we're going to be thinking about new ideas for progressive politics. What we're going to do at the start, though, is try and work out where the hell are we in British politics? Try and take a little bit of a step back. We've had a bit of a summer break. We've enjoyed silly season immensely while checking Twitter on the beach with our cornettos. A year ago, I was casting a vote for Bantasaurus Rex Owen Smith to be Labour's next Prime Minister. A lot has changed since then, listeners. A lot has changed. Let's try and make sense of it. Politician in Britain, which is like a colossus, beating all comers, seeing off challenges from Murdoch and Theresa May, Owen Smith, even, dare one say it, even David Miliband, is of course bearded Lazarus Jeremy Corbyn, who is striding along the stage of British politics, understandably like a cat that thought it had a bowl of diseased scummy cream that turns out in fact to be a bowl of the greatest cream you've ever tasted.
No, it's not quite cream because he didn't win, so it's like whole fat milk.
Okay, Labour's got a lead in the polls.
3%? Something like that?
Something like a small lead of 2 or 3%, which is the first time it's had a consistent lead in a national opinion poll for about 3 years. We have to go back to the glory days of Ed Miliband. By glory days, of course, I mean...
Oh, thank God, why?
That kind of feeling of nagging disappointment. Back in those days, of course, it was rumoured that Ed Miliband had a 35% strategy because our plan was that all we needed was 35% of the electorate and then the electoral system, such as it was, would do the rest. This time, Labour polled 40% and still didn't get an overall majority, which maybe tells you how misguided the 35% strategy was. I find Labour's poll lead odd at the moment because on the one hand I've kind of got used to Labour having a 15 point or 20 point
deficit.
Yeah, and somehow it feels, given the recent election, given the government, given the fact that Prime Minister's authority has been shot, it feels like Labour's lead should be more than it is.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of those things where you might expect it of this podcast, and almost certainly of me, to kind of come out with this. But I think this is one of those things where it does boil down to Corbyn. Whilst Corbyn has done spectacularly well as part of the general election, and hasn't done anything really that wrong since the general election that I can think of.
If we can't think of it, it probably didn't happen.
Yeah, there's been a few kind of minor hiccups over Venezuela and things like that, but nothing that actually matters to the electorate at large. But essentially, Corbyn still faces a significant issue in that got reasonable ratings with younger people. The problem is he's still got very poor ratings with the older half of the electorate, and they still really don't like him for various reasons. And as a result of that, you're never going to see a Corbyn landslide. You may very well see at the next general election a Corbyn victory, but based on the kind of polling we're seeing now, it's probably not going to be enough to get a Corbyn majority government. You'll see a Labour minority in requiring some form of deal with probably the Liberal Democrats.
Or the SNP, but that would be...
Here is the thing. I mean, this is another thing that's working out actually in Corbyn's favour. The SNP is on the retreat in Scotland and is seemingly collapsing a little bit.
Nicola Sturgeon going to be another politician that Corbyn sees off.
Quite possibly.
Maybe he'll see a comeback from Tony Blair. Uh-huh. That would be exciting. You'd mentioned stuff like the Venezuela issue.
Yeah.
What I think most Labour MPs I think assumed would happen is that Labour would get obliterated at a subsequent election, mm-hmm. at which point they would get their party back, mm-hmm. for want of a better way of putting it. Or so they'd either be Corbyn is kicked out and we have a nice soft left leader who will give Labour a nice lead to 5 or 10% before they crumble in this short campaign. Or you'd have a new party set up. And I'm told, I was at Lambeth Country Show a couple of months ago, speaking to some activists there on the Labour stand from Streatham Labour Party, which is Chukwuemeka's seat. They were saying that there were rumours of Chukwuemeka maybe starting a centrist party, mm-hmm. with some other maybe more liberal Tories, maybe even getting the Lib Dems involved as well. They all got very, very quickly shelved on the 7th of June for very, very obvious reasons. So what you've got instead are a series, you've got a cold war at the moment between Corbyn, the PLP, a lot of the membership. And that cold war is playing out in a various different hot wars. So we've seen the controversy over Venezuela, which we'll talk a little bit about in our next episode. Controversies over deselection. We've seen a Labour councillor, Amina Lone, get deselected, apparently for her poor attendance record, but it seems very strange coming off the heels of a lot of the comments that she's been making supporting Sarah Champion's remarks. So not everything is well in Labour. We haven't even got on to their Brexit position yet. But it feels like for now, everyone is very happy with how Corbyn did, and the vast majority are happy there's no leadership speculation at all. I think what's obvious though is Corbyn is a very, very lucky politician.
Yes. They used to say that David Cameron was the luckiest politician that had ever lived. I actually think it's Corbyn now.
No, yeah, when you look at the opponents he's had, both in the 2015 leadership election, wasn't a great field really. You look at the 2016 leadership election, if they'd have picked most other people in the PLP other than Brontosaurus Rex, who no one had heard of. If Theresa May hadn't have decided to call an election without having a manifesto or a plan or a personality, Corbyn's issues and Labour's issues over Brexit, I don't think it will get as... it won't come to a head. I don't think his position in Labour is in any way threatened by it at all. The impression I get from most Labour members is they aren't really that fussed about the EU, and they have a feeling that Corbyn, when it comes to the crunch, will do the right thing. Now, as you might have noticed if you're a regular listener, we are a little bit more sceptic of Corbyn than your average Momentum member. I'm not quite sure I'd entirely agree with that. I think the fascinating thing actually over the next year is going to be, does Corbyn change the Labour position on Brexit to match the vast majority of the membership? Or do the younger Momentum members of Labour change their position on Brexit to match Corbyn's position? I think that's going to be an interesting dynamic.
I think there's been some quite interesting commentary on this already. I think it's almost certainly Stephen Bush has written something about it, because Stephen Bush writes about pretty much everything and is normally correct 99% of the time. And essentially, he's kind of the view that I think I agree with is that people know that Corbyn, it doesn't necessarily share that view on Brexit, which a lot of the membership and the Momentum members have, or Labour members in general as well. But it doesn't necessarily matter because, one, they think Corbyn is a good guy, and therefore if we're going to have a situation where, you know, we're going to be outside the EU, it's better to have our good guy in than their bad guys. But also, he's got enough political credit to burn through with them because he's known to be more left-wing. You know, his stance on a lot of issues is also resonates quite strongly with them. So the fact that this one area, yes, it's a very big area, yes, it's a very important area, but it is not necessarily seen as the biggest and most important area for the vast majority of the membership. And I think that's where that kind of disconnect lies between what most people are saying and, oh, Momentum are going to just go out, be absolutely furious when they realise that Corbyn's a Brexiter. No. Momentum probably already know that. They know that he's never been a full-hearted supporter of the EU, but he's got enough credit with them that it doesn't matter. You know, as things go on, and I think certainly if you were to look forward to a Corbyn premiership, you would probably find that Corbyn's political credit with members would burn out very quickly for other reasons. But I think on this one at the moment, I don't think it matters. People as a whole accept that we're going to leave the EU. And to be honest, I think most people don't necessarily care at this point what that looks like.
No, I think it's very difficult to get into the specifics of it, I think, unless you are really delving into the details of that, which I think we are going to do in various episodes in the season, if probably not in this one. What a lot of Jeremy's supporters in Momentum and those in the media as well, not thinking about anyone in particular, Owen Jones, but they're making, I think, the same mistake over Brexit and accepting Brexit as a lot of moderate Labour members did, a lot of moderate Labour MPs did in accepting austerity, in that a lot of sensible Labour members ended up being, as Paul Krugman would call them, the very serious people who felt that austerity was necessary and that Labour should back austerity to be sensible, even though there's lots of evidence that you don't need austerity, that it had this political cost, and Labour essentially needed to look tough on the economy, it needed to look economically credible. Most people agreed with the fact we needed austerity, and so therefore went along with austerity. And I think you can see the same thing happening with a lot of Corbyn fans saying, well, we need to accept the EU referendum results. Most people agree that Brexit should happen. Therefore, we should put aside our concerns about it and look serious and sensible and back Brexit.
Yeah.
Now that you've got a lot of people unhappy with austerity and the narrative is changing, that Corbyn, because he's been very, very anti-austerity from the beginning, has the credibility to champion that cause in a way that, let's be honest, someone like, say, Andy Burnham would not have done.
Absolutely.
I think it's quite a shame to see them making the same mistake, especially when they've got the evidence of Labour moderates. And in fact, those same people, Owen Jones, would have written thousands of articles castigating Labour MPs.
Did write thousands of articles and thousands of words on those very subjects,
saying that they'd lost their principles on austerity.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's also another side to the Brexit situation for Labour as well, which is, pray to God that actually Corbyn doesn't actually be in a position where he has to negotiate anything. And I'm not even saying that in terms of I don't think he'd negotiate a good deal or anything like that. I'm just saying the minute Corbyn gets into a position where he has to negotiate something, he owns that. It's very, very easy for him to be able to kind of utilise his I believe in good things, therefore I can utilise that as a bit of a shield against my views on Brexit and my views on Europe and things like that, when he's not actually calling the shots. If, say, we end up with some form of transitionary deal, there's an election, and then Corbyn ends up as Prime Minister, which is, you know, feasible, certainly feasible, the new Labour government is going to be responsible for taking over the reins of Brexit negotiations and trying to manage out and build that new relationship with Europe. It's going to be responsible for building out and managing the trade deals, which would come in from other parts of the world as well, which, regardless of your view about how easy or not those things are going to be to get, they need to happen. Otherwise, we will struggle economically. And the thing is, those will involve controversial decisions, some of which Corbyn will absolutely not have the same kind of issues as the Tories will. If the US turns around and says, actually, we want to get more involved in the NHS and run your public healthcare services, Corbyn will just say no. And he avoids that issue. Things like that chlorinated chicken debate that came through the other day, or the few weeks ago, are examples of the kind of ridiculously nitty-gritty details Brexit negotiations or any kind of trade negotiations tend to hinge on. And it sounds ridiculous, but a trade deal with the US could fall apart because we don't want to allow them to import chlorinated chicken. Now, at any given point, Corbyn will have to make a call on this deal goes forward or this bit doesn't. And if he judges wrong on any of these random little things which the public could kick up a fuss about, well, suddenly he's in a massive, massive problem, especially as we've seen already, Corbyn, much like Theresa May, isn't very good with the details of these sorts of things. When he's interested, when it's something he's relevant, where he considers to be highly relevant and interesting, he's a passionate speaker, he can reel off facts and figures as much as he likes. You don't see him doing it in the same way that Cameron or Blair did, though, or even Ed Miliband, in terms of just being able to get into the figures and just remember and kind of reel them off as part of your spiel to the public. He doesn't do that. So he's going to have a potential issue around there, which is why if Corbyn does end up in a situation negotiating stuff, things could go tits up very quickly.
Expect headlines about Corbynated chicken,
ooh,
I would say.
Ooh, that's a good one.
You heard it here first, listeners. The person who is negotiating Brexit, such as, well, I use the word negotiated in its loosest possible sense, it's Theresa May and David Davis, and we should probably talk a little bit about the governing party. Theresa May, of course, having to essentially balance the fact that a lot of her MPs actually want Britain to be a functioning economic power after Brexit, while having to balance the fact that there's a lot of mad, insane, Eurosceptic MPs who won't be happy unless Britain is actually physically pulled away 50 miles away from the EU at the end of the negotiation process. Over the summer, a lot of Brexit position papers were published, which basically said, we don't want to be part of the European Court of Justice / Customs Union / Single Market. Instead, we want to have our own bespoke British version of
the European... all of these things.
Yes, which makes no sense when, as even Peter Hitchens has said, why don't you just join the EEA? It's a very simple solution. You've got tailor-made already bespoke positions where you could leave the EU and be able to negotiate trade in EFTA, the European Free Trade situation, a bit like the Swiss model, where they've got lots of bilateral treaties, but it just about keeps the show on the road.
Yeah.
But because you've got people like Jacob Rees-Mogg saying, well, you're either in the EU or out of the EU, and because May has essentially boxed herself in by saying, we'll leave the single market, leave the customs union, she's got no room to negotiate. And we've just spunked away 6 months of negotiating time on a wasted general election and a French election as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things to hit on here. One is the fact that we're only just producing these position papers now. Partly that's just down to be honest, I think incompetence in terms of the current government, but also incompetence in terms of the previous Tory administration under David Cameron. This is the sort of stuff that should have been done in the run-up to the referendum, just on the off chance that a no vote had occurred.
We're just having the first ever economic impact of students from outside the UK. That first study is being commissioned now, of all times.
Yeah.
It makes absolutely no sense.
No, as I say, so much of this should have been done so much earlier. I think, you know, some of the position papers actually are reasonable. They are actually decent kind of attempts to look at various aspects of leaving the EU. The problem is that so many of the really big issues are still obfuscated under these ridiculous kind of notions of, are we going to be part of the customs union? No, we can't be part of the customs union, because if we're a part of the customs union, then we're not going to be able to cut free trade deals with other countries, so we can't be a part of that. But the government, whilst they're saying that, they're still not saying that. You still have aspects of the government kind of saying, well, actually, we might be.
Well, and you mentioned just now that as soon as Corbyn needs to negotiate anything specific, his credibility might be a bit tainted. Well, Theresa May faces this problem, and David Davis, say, faces this problem every time they go into negotiations.
Yep.
So you had David Davis coming out and briefing to The Sun, saying that he was going to come out and attack Brussels for being stubborn and unreasonable. Now, I always find, Steve, whenever you're going to negotiate anyone, I'm guessing you're the same when you want to negotiate your salary, the first thing you do is you attack your bosses for being stubborn and unreasonable before you go and negotiate with
absolutely,
them.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, that's gotten me all of the results I've ever wanted in life. Yeah, it's just pure political posturing from David Davis's part, which I suspect is more to do with a potential leadership ambition than actual anything to do with the Brexit negotiations. I mean, to a certain extent, like, the EU knows that every politician has an audience to play up for at home, and that they've got to, and they will always take into account that kind of thing. You know, politics isn't like big business. You know, there's always the outside, more outside forces which are going to shape positioning and shape rhetoric. So to a certain extent, I expect the EU to kind of roll their eyes a little bit and kind of go, well, yeah, it's fair enough, but Merkel did the same thing a couple of months back over this issue. Macron will do something similar, and, you know, everyone will do it in one form or another. I think the problem is that we're not normally, when you have that sort of thing going on, you've also got something a bit more solid and obvious to get your teeth into at the same time. And I think that's what we're missing currently from the government.
Well, quite. It feels like all of the government's all of the government management on the Brexit negotiations is all about managing the reaction of the right-wing media in Britain. It's not about seeing what the EU wants. And Ian Dunt has written some quite interesting articles on this, saying, well, there's no positives the EU is getting from these Brexit negotiations. All it's about is mitigating the damage that would happen to Britain if it left all the EU institutions and left all the single market. And it's hard to know if this is, as you say, is it the start of a David Davis leadership bid? Is it the start of Britain maybe walking away from EU talks and trying to flounce out, which, I mean, would be absolutely insane if it were to happen.
Yeah, it would be absolutely insane. And it's the sort of thing which might work very well and appeal to, like, a certain part of the Tory base. But it's the sort of activity which would lead to a split-off Conservative Party forming in the form with the likes of Heidi Allen, Anna Selbury, maybe even the likes of Amber Rudd actually just going, screw it, this isn't worth it. This isn't going to work. These people are more concerned with their own jobs rather than the actual state of this country. It would also just make Corbyn's job so much easier. Even if you didn't have that Tory split, you would just have such an economic drop off of the minute that we walked away in a flounce, that any election that comes off of the back of that would be dealing with would probably be in the middle of a recession. Well,
and the pound to the euro is already
basically parity.
Yeah.
The minute the pound actually ends up dropping below the euro and the euro becomes more valuable than the pound, that's when you're actually going to see an awful lot of, certainly in place, not necessarily the Express, but certainly in things like the Sun, a lot more of a kind of a shift in terms of attitude towards these sort of things. Because, again, whilst the Sun has never been EU-friendly, actually, when you look at a load of their editors and their politics kind of team, like, you can actually see that during the referendum they were going around supporting the Remain side of the campaign. So I think what you'll probably find is a shift in tone on the back of, well, it's now really, really expensive for us to go abroad in France at the moment. Well, yeah, because the pound slipped. But that's the sort of thing which will make it much more obvious and is understandable to people that this may not be necessarily a good thing for Britain, because everyone kind of knows that a weaker pound is bad. But until you actually get into the thing of, this means I have less money to spend on my holidays next year, it doesn't actually hit through to people at all.
No. We're not going to talk too much about the Lib Dems, obviously. We had the podcast on them last week. UKIP and the Greens as well. UKIP are going through a quite hilariously terrible leadership election, which I think we'll try and do a podcast on as well. The return to two-party politics means that their poll numbers are very small at the moment. They are recovering after the election. It's a kind of historic low for all those three parties, and they're bouncing back up, which I suppose is natural after an election protest, where people end up showing that they don't like, it's the none of the above by then supporting the other small parties. Let's quickly think, apart from Brexit and the ramifications for the Tory party and the Labour party that Brexit will entail, what do you think might be the big stories over the year in politics?
So over the next year or so, I'm expecting a lot of, I don't know if necessarily these will be big stories in terms of making massive headlines, but I think these are the sorts of stories which could be very influential in terms of actually impacting how government goes about actually dealing with policy. Is I'm expecting a lot more kind of chaos at a local level. For local governments, councils and things, as it hits a point where they're still being asked to make more cuts and yet there's nothing left to cut. Like in Birmingham, we've recently, I don't think they've officially ended yet.
It's suspended at the moment.
Yeah, we are currently in the middle of a suspended strike by basically the rubbish collectors over changes to contracts and potential layoffs and cuts to salaries, all kinds of different things. But, you know, that's been a pretty big thing in Birmingham. I think it's received a bit of coverage overall in the country. But I'm expecting to see a lot more of those sorts of things. Now, granted, you probably wouldn't get the same kind of level of attention as the Birmingham situation has done, because not all play councils are as big as Birmingham. I mean, Birmingham is the biggest single unitary authority, I think, in Europe. But I can easily see there being similar sorts of situations happening all over the country, and I can see lots of areas, both Conservative and Labour and Lib Dem, and even the one or two UKIP or SNP ones that exist, all kind of struggling to balance the budget and still deliver services, which means we're going to end up with more kind of potential strike actions in certain areas, which means we're going to end up with some cuts going right down to the bone in other areas, which will mean that the local government is basically just doing what they are legally mandated to do, and in some cases I suspect doing it, but doing it badly. And I think that will be revealed over the next year or maybe two, which I think is going to massively impact on, over time, how we actually look at government funding for local government, so that we can actually go, well, actually, if we're saying they need to do this, where is that money coming from? Because at the moment, you know, it's an astounding percentage of local government money comes directly from central government. Now, you're always going to have a lot of that happening, because there are some councils which, just for, you know, your rural councils, for instance, they're never going to be able to charge business rates in the same way that Birmingham or Manchester will be able to, because they don't have businesses in those areas. That's where people live. It's not where they work. But there's going to be lots of different ways that we can look at funding, and I suspect that's going to be a conversation that will start happening with a bit more urgency over the next year or so.
Absolutely, and certainly in schools you've had schools, say, closing half an hour early to try and reduce staffing costs, maybe even closing on a Friday afternoon for reducing staffing costs. I think you'll see a lot more stories like that. I think you've said one or two times on this podcast that people will only start turning against austerity when they see it affect their own lives. I think that's starting to happen. I think the election result is a sign that's happening.
It's a kickback against a lot of those sorts of things, absolutely.
Because Labour's vote wasn't just from the very, very young, it was also from people aged between about 35 and 45 who probably have maybe parents who in hospital, or they might have children at schools who are seeing the effect of austerity firsthand. Sort of related to that, in the continuing narrative against austerity, I think the fallout from the Grenfell Tower tragedy is going to be another big story that will rumble on over the next year. We've got an inquiry set up, and it'll be interesting to see what that inquiry finds. Grenfell itself, I think, was used just after the election, was seen as a metaphor by many people for the failure of austerity. And I think the fact it's in the news, we'll see that kind of drip of stories of people who've been placed, that their needs have been placed below the needs of that of profit and a quick profit, by the looks of things. At the moment, I think only 9 people have been rehoused, I think, from the tower who were living there. And I think the other story this week was that people are bidding against each other for houses, so they're having to bid against other residents of the tower to live in houses. It's absolutely despairing and tragic, and I think that tragedy is just going to justifiably, one could say, is going to be dominating the news in one way or another. There's a couple of quick stories as well, I suppose. Obviously, Donald Trump is going to be in the news for so many reasons. The fact that he's still got the offer of a state visit by Theresa May pending, I think, is going to be a bit of an embarrassment to her. It'll be interesting to see if he comes.
Yeah, I mean, with that, I mean, there's already been kind of talks of Trump doing a practice run and kind of turning up in the UK unannounced, doing a quick kind of tour of something or other for, say, around London, just to get a couple of basic meetings in, and then buggering off again, just to see if it's actually possible for Trump to get into Britain and not be protested against. I don't think that's going to be very successful. And I think any time that a state visit like that is set to happen, you are going to see massive protests, because Trump, especially after his reaction and remarks and actions coming off the back of the Charlottesville situation and pardoning of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Somebody summed it up quite nicely on my Twitter timeline this morning, which I fully agree with this, is I'm not one for rallies, I'm not one for marches, I don't see the point in them normally. I don't necessarily think they serve that much of a purpose when it comes to politics, other than kind of a feel-good factor and getting people who agree with each other together and kind of building that networks. But I will happily cancel my weekend plans and go down to a protest against Trump. I've already been to one or two things locally as they've happened in Birmingham. You know, if he comes along, there will be an awful lot of people and not just the usual suspects turning out for those events.
Hmm. Steve Haynes going to a rally is another example of how Jeremy Corbyn is laying waste to all before him.
I know. The world is changing. I don't like it.
One EU leader who did invite Trump on a state visit and coincidentally has seen his popularity plummet in his first 100 days of office is Emmanuel Macron.
Who's managed to spend something like £24,000 on makeup in his first like 100 days.
Which is impressive. Although the most impressive thing from the Telegraph article is that François Hollande, a man who has about the same amount of hair as I do, has managed to spend, well, his personal barber was being paid $90,000 a year.
Seriously? Bloody hell. We're in the wrong job.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, as well as Macron, and he's talking about maybe trying to reform freedom of movement in the EU, trying to do it with other EU countries rather than on its own, like David Cameron was proposing. It'll be interesting to see how far he goes. There's also a German election coming up in less than a month, and it's going to be interesting to see, will Angela Merkel still be Chancellor? Probably. But then could there be a Schulz surge? It'll be interesting to see how that goes. And the politics in Europe, especially when you look at countries like Hungary, countries like Poland, countries like Turkey, who are...
Oh, Turkey and Poland in particular, having some interesting authoritarian traits emerging amongst them.
Mm. And those that kind of shift to authoritarianism rather than liberal democracy, I think, will be a big theme as well, especially with the fact that we've got the president of the USA openly endorsing fascists. I think they're all going to be quite big stories as well. Anything you want to add before we...
I think the only thing really to add is you should totally like us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. You should subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. If you are subscribed to the podcast, you should totally tweet out or share on with Facebook or LinkedIn or whatever your social media platform of choice is the link to this episode, so that all of your friends and families can start listening and subscribe as well.
Do, if you have not already, read The Very British Coup. I promise we will talk about it in a book club very, very soon. I'm at Paperback Writer.
I'm at Centre Radical.
Our logo was designed by James Cram, and our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper. Happy plotting, everyone.